Yep. I'm so excited. I love ICS. There's only one thing in exchange that I love more than fast transfer.
But I thought fast transfer was slow.
Ironically, fast transfer isn't the fastest transfer there is out there. If you're copying data with, I was saying in the break, if you're copying data between the same logon or in the same mailbox, don't use fast transfer. It's because it has to take all the data through the client and back up. All the operations like copy to, copy properties, copy folder, copy message have a on-server copy equivalent. It's just ROP copy to, ROP copy folder, ROP copy messages. I think most of the parameters are identical. All it does is just copy the data between two objects that are within the same mailbox. And it does an on-server copy, so it's very fast. So there's very fast copy, there's fast copy, and then there's do it on your own by reading properties and setting properties. That's slow copy. Okay, this talk is about incremental change synchronization. It's Exchange's way of giving the client the ability to replicate changes that occur within a folder or within a hierarchy between two different points in time. Outlook, for example, will replicate content in a folder. It has what we call the it maintains a state. The client maintains a state for the replication of that folder. And when it wants to go to the server to replicate changes for that folder, it has to pass up the state to the server. So the server kind of gets an idea of what the client state is. So then it can evaluate the client state and then the state of what's in the server and then just return changes to that particular client state. So what we'll talk today is about the incremental change synchronization state, what the state looks like, how you create an ICS download context. ICS download uses the fast transfer mechanism. It's another ROP to be able to create the serializer context, but it uses the fast transfer source get buffer operation to actually retrieve a serialized representation of the changes within a folder or hierarchy. We'll talk about how the client uploads its state to that synchronization object that it creates. So the server is able to produce a set of changes between when the client previously synced the folder or synchronized the folder. This operation, it's kind of a repeat of the previous slide deck where we talked about fast transfer and how to do the source get buffer. And I'll explain what the synchronization fast download fast transfer stream looks like. There's some additional markers, what the content stream looks like, and what a hierarchy stream looks like. I'll then briefly discuss how Exchange sort of evaluates and determines what's changed within a folder based on the state. Then I will talk about how Exchange allows a client to upload changes to the server. It doesn't use fast transfer, but there's a new ROP called Open Collector. It's a way to, the client can open a collector, passes up state to it, and then the client could then upload message changes or deletions or read unread state changes, and then the server will update. It doesn't use put buffer. Doesn't use fast transfer. You'll see. It has different ROPs. These ROPs down here has ROP import message change and ROP import delete. There's actually two others for messages. There's a ROP import move message and read unread state change. I didn't include all of them because I know this is going to go way over an hour.
Just on the high level, each step creates the handle for the next step, but the ICS configure will create the state for the state synchronization.
So
the state synchronization will create the object of the fast transfer.
Good question. The question was, every state creates a new object handle. Here, we can get into it, but the synchronization configure will create a serializer context object or a synchronization context object that is an object in itself which is returned. You can then execute these operations against that object. These don't actually produce objects. This is just a mechanism in which to pass up data. And then the get buffer, of course, doesn't produce an object. It just returns data from that object.
So the only object that is,
so the only object the that's created is this one here. Yeah. Okay. And of course, you have to release it when you're done. Here's my overview. I probably already said it. A mechanism to replicate or enumerate changes to a folder hierarchy or content. Utilizes fast transfer when enumerating changes from the server to the client, but the client doesn't use fast transfer to enumerate or pass changes back up. I guess the reasoning for that is kind of a little blurb here, is that if it uses fast transfer, the client doesn't know the server may already have the item. I mean, if you have replication loops, you could get a situation where the server already has the item, the client doesn't know it, the client spends all this time replicating the data up to the server, and the server says, I already have it. And then he would have to just continue reading from the fast transfer stream just to skip the item. Okay, the ICS state. It basically is, you can kind of think of it like a watermark. It's basically a representation of what the client has already synchronized with the server, what it has already downloaded, and what it represents what the client should have. It's kept and stored solely on the client. The server doesn't keep track of these states. When it comes to ICS, the server is stateless. It's dumb. It doesn't know anything. It relies on the client to pass the state up before it can actually produce the delta or the list of changes. Inside of the state, there's four properties that are what we call the ICS state. We have the ID set given, which is essentially it's a collection or it's a set of all the IDs that were given to the client. If you're doing hierarchy replication, this would be folder IDs. If you're doing message replication, this would be message IDs or MIDs. It contains a CN set scene, which basically is a list of all the change number values for all the changes that have been downloaded. CN set scene FAI, which is a list of all the change numbers for folder associated messages, and it's only for content synchronization. These last two really aren't for hierarchy, don't exist in the ICS state for hierarchy. CN set red is basic list of all the CNs that are associated for read and unread state changes.
So what does it mean, read and unread?
When you just mark an item red, the Exchange server distinguishes that differently than actually changing a message. Used to be ICS, when you changed a message on the server, the way ICS works is it says, oh, this message is changed, and it downloads the entire message. This was a mechanism in which somebody could mark an item as read on the server, where just the read state of the message is just replicated, and the entire content of the message is not.
So it's just like saying that the client already got that information, or it's the client opened the message?
The state properties basically give a representation of what the server has already replicated to the client. Okay. It's just a collection of all the changes that have been replicated to the client.
No, but I'm referring to the CN set red. Is that referring to the fact that the server already sent it to the client? Or it's referred that the Outlook, the user, opened this message? Is that the read property?
It just refers to the fact that that particular read change, whether the change was to be marked read or marked unread, was replicated. It doesn't distinguish whether or not someone has actually opened it or not.
Okay, so if it's turned on, you wouldn't get it, you wouldn't synchronize it on the next time that the client comes?
Right.
Although it's not part of the...
So if you originally received a message and it was marked unread, it would come down as a message change. Now, if somebody marked it as read on the server, it would come down as just a change that would say that this message has now been read. I mean, that's the change. Then if you marked it unread again, it would come down as another change to say this message is now being transitioned into the unread state.
And is there a way to turn on off this thing, or it's a server internal thing?
There's some configuration flags when you configure the synchronization download object to say whether or not you want read unread changes to be replicated. There's also a way to say whether or not you want deletes replicated. So there's ways to enable or disable certain functionality.
Okay. Thank you.
Excuse me, one more question. What are the CNs there? Change numbers? Those are MIDs and FIDs? Or?
It's a collection of change numbers.
Okay, those are basically folder IDs and message IDs?
Inside of the Exchange subsystem, whenever an object is changed, it gets a new change number value.
Okay, it's a monotonic sum number version.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Each of these properties are binary properties. When they go across the wire, they are serialized into... internally, we keep them as a set or an object, but it gets serialized into a binary property when it goes across the wire. Inside of this document, it gives details on how this particular ID set is serialized. I don't go into that description here because that in itself is a lengthy process. But these properties on the wire are just... conceptually, just binary properties. This is kind of what I threw this in here. This might just add more confusion than it actually helps, but it's kind of a conceptual image of what an ID set or CN set would look like in memory. They're separated out by replit ID, or I guess we call that now namespace ID, and it's associated with the namespace GUID. So they get each database or each namespace that is assigning IDs will have its own namespace ID, or each namespace that's assigning changes will have its own space. And within there, you'll have distinct ranges of values. I don't know if you guys have seen what a MID looks like internally or a change number looks like internally, but it's represented by 2 bytes, which represent the namespace ID or the replid, and 6 bytes, which represent the glob count. So as you're collecting all of these values together, they get kind of collapsed into ranges. So conceptually, wrong button. Nope. I guess I was going the right way. It just conceptually gets broken down into different ranges. So it's not actually every single value that's there. It gets collapsed into ranges. So to create the ICS download context, you issue the ROP synchronization configure. It creates a synchronization object. You can use it to synchronize hierarchy and content. Content synchronization is shallow. It will only synchronize the content within a specific folder in which you create the context object. Hierarchy will actually synchronize the hierarchy from that root folder down. It's not from the root folder of the mailbox. It's from whatever folder you create the synchronizer on. It'll synchronize the hierarchy from that folder down. And it doesn't include content. So it's just replicating hierarchy. Like if you delete a folder, create a folder, it'll replicate that hierarchy.
So I have a question about the ICS state. Let's say it's fully synchronized. Would that be, let's say I have Outlook and I've been working with that for 1 year and I did like thousands or a couple of thousands of synchronization, but I'm totally synchronized between my client and server. So will my ICS state will be one item, or it will be all the items of all the synchronization?
It's still going to be a set of all the items that the client should have.
So it doesn't merge, you know, like if one set is added change to the next set, it doesn't merge them. It keeps them...
It'll collapse ranges together, obviously. If you add an item and it makes 2 ranges go to 1 range, it'll collapse.
Okay.
The server does some tricks. When it's assigning IDs, it doesn't assign them randomly across folders. It'll allocate a range of IDs for a given folder. So when it's assigning IDs in a folder, it'll be within a certain block. That's mainly done so the ICS states can collapse. The ranges will collapse. So you're not getting IDs spread out across the entire database within a folder. You're just getting IDs that are specifically for that folder.
So practically, like, how many bytes these states get to be for, you know, someone who works with Outlook on a daily basis?
It's hard to say. I mean, there's obviously the case where the state represents the IDs that the client has, and when you delete an item, it removes it from that state. So the pathological case is you create a bunch of items, then you delete every other item, so nothing collapses. We've seen some states get pretty large, but
like
generally...
Like X of bytes, K of bytes?
The largest I've ever seen was like 128K, and that was for like a public folder, and that's pretty rare.
Okay.
The change numbers can collapse really well, because the server just keeps assigning change numbers increasing over time. So the CN set, it optimizes it where it says, I'm going to give you all the changes within this folder. So once it's replicated all the changes, it knows any new change in that folder is going to get a value higher than the highest value within that folder. So it can collapse that entire set to just everything between 1 and the highest value.
So it's a good estimation to say that the stream synchronization will take between 1 to 3 round trips of RPCs. You know, like if each RPC is 32K.
It depends on what you're replicating. I mean, if you're just replicating one new message that came in, say the client gets a new mail notification, it wants to replicate one folder, it opens the folder, it passes up, it creates the synchronizer, it passes up the state. It could then turn around and within the same call say, get me the first buffer. And if they use that BABE, they should be able to get data in the first round trip. And generally, if the message is small, Outlook should be able to synchronize the new message in one call. So this operation, it's combined. One of the property types is synchronization type. It says whether you're doing content or hierarchy. Of course, you have to do it on a folder object. There's synchronization flags, which basically control how the data is serialized and what gets serialized. And we didn't have enough room, so we came up with extra flags, which is more additional flags on how and what gets serialized. There's also restriction. Restriction data is essentially a restriction, as like a mappy restriction. And it basically, on content synchronization only, you can actually synchronize just a restricted view of a folder. You could say, I only want only synchronize messages that conform to this particular restriction. It's interesting because when you replicate deletes, if an item all of a sudden gets changed and it no longer is within that restriction, it'll come down and return what we call a soft delete. It'll basically say, this item you need to delete because it no longer is within the restricted view. This isn't as rich as something you could do on a table. It's limited on the type of restriction you can do here. I don't think you can be extremely complex with it, but it does allow you to do certain things like only replicate messages that are less than a certain size or messages that don't have attachments and things like that. Property tags is basically a list of properties to either include or exclude, and whether or not you include or exclude is based off of this synchronization flag, which is only specified properties. If you pass the only specified properties, this is a list of properties where you only want it to return a finite set of properties for every message change that it's going to download. What a client could conceptually do is produce sort of a manifest. So instead of replicating the entire message if it's changed, just replicate a certain number of properties that allow the client to identify it as, oh, here's some items that have changed. And if the client wants to turn around and open up the item and do whatever it wants, he could do that. Sometimes a client might not want to replicate the entire content. It might want to just know what's changed and then be able to open the item and just pick and choose what it wants to get from it. The operations that are used to synchronize the ICS state is basically there's three operations. Once you've created the synchronization download context object, you can issue these synchronization upload state stream begin, continue, and end. The begin is basically just a way to tell the context object, I'm starting to upload a particular property of the state. In the next slide, you'll see that this particular ROP includes the property or the stream property. This ROP that you pass up actually includes the a chunk of that stream. It could be large where you have to pass it up in multiple of these. It might be larger than 32K. And then when you finally passed up the entire stream, you pass up this ROP at the end that basically says, I'm done. Now the download context object can actually take that property and put it into its ICS state. Again, if it's large, it'll be multiple of it. You'll see a lot of these on the wire. You'll see a begin, and then you'll see continue, of course, spread across different RPC calls. And then you'll see the begin, continue, end repeated once for every state property. So here, you can do the begin. It takes the state property, which is one of the four. And then the total size of the state that it's going to be uploaded. You use continue to actually upload a chunk of that state. It doesn't have to be all of this, but it could just be part of it. And you would just issue more of them until the entire data is up. And then when you're finally done, you just issue this ROP. It doesn't take anything other than the context object. It just says, OK, I'm done. The server can then just validate links, make sure everything's OK, then put it into its state. So conceptually, you'll see on the wire for content synchronization, you'll see the synchronization configure. You'll see the individual state properties go up with the begin, continue, end, begin, continue, end, begin, continue, end, on down. And normally, you will see a fast transfer source git buffer. This is all in one RPC if the state is small. And you'll see the fast transfer source git buffer also included in there so that it can return the first chunk on the first call. And I think that's what this just says. These will all go up in one. The Outlook client will pass them all up in one ROP. Now, certainly, if you're implementing a client and you don't want to be as efficient as Outlook, you could certainly do all these in separate RPC calls if you want to. So to get the fast transfer stream, to retrieve the fast transfer stream of the synchronization changes, you call fast transfer source get buffer. You're going to, of course, have to call this multiple times if there's a lot of changes. And of course, don't forget to release the synchronization object. The Exchange team will love you for it. Don't leave objects open. And of course, you only release it when you're done downloading the entire stream. Okay, so what does the actual fast transfer stream look like? The fast stream is kind of like the bulk copy fast transfers. Except that we introduced a new set of markers. And then the actual stream, it's logically divided up into four parts. You will first get all of the changes within the folder. It means whether there's a new item or an item was changed. Then you'll get the deletions. And then if it's for content synchronization, you will get all the read state changes in that order. And then the last piece, you'll get the final ICS state. Now, the final ICS state is essentially a serialization of those four same state properties, but they represent the final state of what everything the client just received. It's the new state that the client can now just persist and then will pass back up to the server when it wants to replicate again. The new markers, it's a bunch of goo. It won't make sense until I show you what the stream looks like, but there's an anchor sync change. This basically says that here's a new change in the stream. I don't really talk about partial changes. In Exchange 2007, we allowed the functionality to, instead of downloading an entire change, we added the functionality to do partial change synchronization. It's in the document. I didn't really get into a lot of detail here in this slide. But there is the facilities to replicate just parts of a message. So what we did is certain groupings of properties within messages got their own change numbers, and we could replicate the message. And then based on the state, we know if the client already has the message and what parts it has, and we keep track of which parts of the message change, and we can just replicate down just changes of the message. And that kind of helps out if you just like change the follow-up flag on a message. You certainly don't want to download all the attachments again. You just want to replicate just those properties. The anchor sync del basically tells the receiver that deletions are now coming in the stream, And the anchor sync end is the property that's always at the very end of the stream that says the synchronization is now done. I don't know why we put that in there to say end when we could have just triggered off of here's the last buffer. We would have figured it out. But there's an end marker. There's an anchor sync read that says following this there are all the read state changes. And then there's an anchor state begin, which basically tells the receiver that, okay, the final state is now going to be interjected in the stream. And then there's an anchor state end, which, again, it just says that we're now finishing the state. So your question is at the end of the stream, are you going to see the anchor state end and then sync end? Yes, you'll generally see those two in order at the very end. I think the server will always return a final state, even if there was nothing to replicate. We had talked about an optimization where if there was nothing to replicate, what's the point of returning the same state the client just gave us? But we never did that optimization. So it'll always return the state. There's some other things here that I don't really get into in the slide. It's with some additions that were added in Exchange 2007 around progress. The client wanted better progress information when it was actually replicating changes. I explained before the fast transfer had the mechanism to say how many parts, where am I at. That was never actually plugged in and did and worked in ICS. But they wanted the ability to give progress information. So there were some markers that get interjected at the beginning and then before each individual change that basically specify the total size of all the messages that are going to be downloaded and then the individual message size. And property group info is related to the partial change. And then sync message is a marker that gets interjected after the sync change. What happens is it says, here's a change, here is some state some properties associated with that change, and then it then includes the entire message after it. Okay, so the content stream roughly for changes roughly looks like this. For each new message or change message that it wants to download, you'll see an anchor sync change followed by a fixed set of required properties. It'll be the source key, the last modification time, the change key, the predecessor change list, and whether it's an associated message. And then based on some extra config flags, it can include the mid, the message size, or the change number into the stream in that order. Beyond these fixed properties, it then has an anchor sync message and then a regular message as you'd normally expect it to be serialized by fast transfer. You'll have the message properties, all the recipients, and then all the attachments. And the attachments, of course, could include embedded messages as well. So deletions for messages are split up into three separate ID sets. So when you get an anchor sync del, means for deletions, there's going to be three binary properties following it. Those three binary properties represent three different ID sets, and that's the set of all IDs the client needs to delete. So there's basically items that were deleted. There's then no longer in scope, so that's if a message falls out of the restricted view. And then expired, if Exchange actually expired an item from the server. So if you pass the synchronization flag no deletes, this anchor sync del won't even be in the stream. It won't return any deletes. Question? Oh, okay. And it'll only actually include this property in the actual stream if there's at least one ID in the set. If there's no items, say there was no items that were no longer in scope, it won't even include that property. Generally, you're just going to see a lot of this. You're not really ever, I don't think Outlook does restricted views for synchronization. It might. I think there's a way to go in and tell the client to restrict what's synchronized. I think it might use it. I'm not sure about expired. I think Exchange does track whether items were expired or actually deleted. So down here is basically what you're going to see after the changes in the stream. You're going to now see the deletes, and it's just an anchor sync del, and then followed by each of the three serialized ID sets for the three different types of deletes. They're all conditional whether or not there's actually any deletes to tell the client about. Yeah.
So the deletion, is that... Can you describe a scenario when the deletion would occur when Outlook client is asking for a state change? Is that happening on the server through some other mechanism, or is just that client, you have... One scenario I can think of is you have two clients. One is deleting and the other is synchronizing. It's getting the deletions. But are there other scenarios where the client is always synchronized, will there be deletions? Yeah, that's two clients scenario.
I'm not sure if I quite understand the question. You're saying if on one client you delete an item?
No, if you just said, I'm just trying to understand the scenarios where the deletions can happen at the server without...
Well, say you have an online client. An online client would delete an item that needs to be replicated to a cache client.
Okay. That's still a two-client scenario.
Well, even if you have two clients, or even if they're both cache clients, one is going to replicate up, or it's going to delete an object, and that needs to be replicated to the other client, the deletion.
Right, but I'm just saying that's only one client, one instance of a client. In that case, will there be a deletion on the server at all?
If you're only deleting things from your client, you probably won't see deletions because the client knows that he's deleted the item, so he'll remove the MID from the ID set given from the ICS state. The client will do that. So that when he goes up to the server to get changes, the server will... In another slide, I talk about how we evaluate what to return. For deletions, we only tell the client to delete items that we think it has. So if that item's MID is not in the ID set given, it won't tell the client to delete the item. So if the client is the one that's initiating the delete, he'll know that he's deleted the item, so it doesn't have to replicate the delete back down. Did I explain what you're asking?
Right. I was thinking, you talked about some server expiring an item.
Sure.
Is that what scenarios would the server expire an item?
I think we have the ability to expire items from folders. I'm not exactly sure 100% how exactly Exchange will do that.
Okay.
The new features that you can
right
policies to expire.
But I'm not exactly 100% sure when it comes to the expired property in the ICS has been around for a long time, and I'm not 100% sure when the new feature in 2010, when it expires items, if that will be triggered as an expiration or just a delete.
Okay.
I'm not 100% sure. So next in the stream is the read state changes.
No, one question, one last question.
Okay.
So the ICS state, there is no state. If a client did not do any action on the server, server will not do any state change behind the client, right? So it's always the client-initiated action.
Right. The server can only evaluate what the state is of the server at that moment. And it evaluates it based on what the ICS state from the client. Now, the client has the ability to modify that state. So if it does actions locally, like in cache mode, if they delete an item or they do some other action, they can modify the state so when they go to download changes, they're not going to get the same change being downloaded back to them.
Right. So if two clients issue the same ICS request, or the same client repeats the same ICS request, they should not get any diffs.
If you sync with the server and you get the final state, but you throw the final state away and you start over with the previous final state, you're going to keep getting the same changes.
Right. But then the sync itself will not cause any state change on the server. It's like a read-only operation.
No, it doesn't. Yeah. Okay. It doesn't change anything on the server.
Okay, thank you.
It just produces a diff and downloads it. It doesn't change anything on the server. Yeah. So the read state consists of two properties, and that's a set of all items that should be marked as read and a set of all items that should be marked as unread. And it's just the items based off of the ICS state. It knows which changes or which read changes the client has already accepted, and it's basically just a set of read state changes that the client hasn't produced, and it's just the message IDs of just the messages that have changed since the last time the client synchronized. This is conditional, of course. It won't include read state changes if the read state flag is not present. And of course, it only includes the property in the stream if there's at least one ID in the set. If the set is empty, it won't include it. So in the stream, you will actually see InkerSync read or InkerSync read, and then you'll see each of the following binary properties, ID set read or ID set unread. And they're all conditional whether or not there's actually something to return. And then, yes?
Let's say I'm synchronizing my inbox and I'm asking for the red ones, so I'll get my inbox from scratch, basically?
Yes.
Okay.
It's a good question. If you're downloading an item and the item is actually going to be fully downloaded as part of a message change or a new message, it won't actually also separately return the read state. If it knows that the read state was just downloaded as the message itself, it won't actually include it in the set of read or unread.
Okay.
Yeah. So the final ICS state is the last part in the stream. You will see an InkerSync begin, followed by the four different state properties, and then you'll see InkerSync state end. It's pretty self-explanatory. Now, obviously for hierarchy, it's going to be different. In hierarchy, it's the last two aren't there. There's only two state properties for hierarchy. So the complete picture is you'll see an InkerSync change followed by InkerSync message with the message, and then you'll see that repeated many, many times for each message change, and then you'll see InkerSync del, which includes all the messages to delete, and InkerSync read, and then you'll see the two InkerSync state begin and end, and then you'll see InkerSync end. And that's the entire stream. So the hierarchy stream, I'll go through this really quick. Time is running short. It's very much like content, except some of these properties are different. So you'll get an InkerSync change. That means a folder change. You'll have source key, last modification time, change key, predecessor change list, display name. And then two conditional properties, the folder ID, if this EID flag is set, and then the parent folder ID if this other flag is set in the configuration, and then all other folder properties. What's different about changes for hierarchy is there's no InkerSync message. There's no sub-block. It just uses this block to say, here's the change, and then it just lists, it's just all the properties of the folder. Since it doesn't include content, there's no sub-objects or anything. It's just all folder properties. Deletions, of course, is very much like changes, except there's just one property tag. There is no out of scope, since you can't do scoping with hierarchy, and there's no expired. I don't think there's a way to expire a folder. So it's just a list of all the folder IDs that need to be deleted. Of course, the no deletions flag, if you pass that, it won't include any deletes. And on the wire, it's just an InkerSync del with just that one property. And then the final ICS state is very short. It just contains the two properties, the ID set given, and that's, of course, the set of all folder IDs, and then all of the folder changes. And then an end. The complete picture, it's just a bunch of InkerSync changes for folder changes, the deletions, then the final state, and then the end marker. So change evaluation. So on the server, every new or changed item will get a new change number. So the server will build a list of change numbers that aren't currently present in the CNSet scene of the state, or also the CNSet scene FAI if it's you're doing a content synchronization. So what it sees is it evaluates the folder. It knows all of the changes within that folder, and it says, is there any messages in this folder that has a change that's not in CNSet scene or CNSet scene FAI? And if there's a change that isn't in one of those, it says, okay, I need to download this message. For delete evaluations, the server, I don't know if this is a must, a capital must, but our server maintains a list of IDs that have existed in the folder that have been deleted, or a list of folders that have been deleted. So when it evaluates deletions, it basically does the union of the ID set given that's passed in the ICS state with the maintained set of IDs, the set of IDs that have been deleted. And if there's any overlap, it knows those are the messages it needs to tell the client to delete. Correct. It's not union. It's the intersection between the two sets. Good catch. I must have typed this up really late at night. It is the intersection between the two sets. So that way, if the ID isn't in the ID set given inside of the state, and if an item was deleted but the client never knew about it, the server won't tell the client to delete it because it never got it. So conceptually, you could think of the client who's replicating. You go offline or you close your laptop. You create an item on the server, then you delete it. That item won't get replicated to the client and then deleted. The client won't even know the item even existed. Read state evaluation. The server internally keeps a read change number property. I'm not really sure if this is actually an accessible property. Outlook never reads it, but internally we keep the concept whenever you change the read state on a message, it has its own change number assigned to that change. So what it does is that it internally from these change numbers, it treats it kind of like it does for change evaluation. It goes through and it says, is there any change number? If there are any read state changes within the folder that aren't represented by the CNSet read, and if there are, it knows. It then evaluates and says, okay, is this message currently marked as read or currently marked as unread, and then puts the message ID in the appropriate, these are read changes or unread changes. And this last little blurb here, if the item is fully being downloaded as part of a change, it excludes it from the read state evaluation. It won't also return the read state. Okay, so upload. So now we've talked about downloading changes. Now we're going to talk about going the other way. The way to accomplish this is you create, you call ROP synchronization open collector. It creates a collector, an object on the server where you can send up changes. There's a should here. You need to upload the state to the collector. So the server, based on the changes that the client's going to pass up, it knows the state of the previous state that the client was at. It doesn't need to pass up all the properties. I'll explain in another slide. It doesn't pass up all four of the properties. So the open collector is on a folder. And you say whether or not you're going to pass up hierarchy changes or you're going to pass up message changes, and it produces this upload context object as output. Okay. So as with download, when you're synchronizing download, you pass up the state. When you're synchronizing upload, you should pass up upload the state. Not all the properties are required to be uploaded, and actually, quite frankly, you don't have to pass up a state if you don't want to. Outlook does, but there's no strict requirement that when you create an upload context that you pass up a state. If you don't pass up a state, the server just assumes that the initial state is empty for all those properties. The CNSet scene should be uploaded for both hierarchy and content. The CNSet scene FAI and CNSet red should be passed up only for content. And again, if you don't pass up a state property, it's just treated as empty. So kind of what you see for, if you're going to upload content changes, you do an open collector, you pass up these three state properties. If you're going to be doing uploading hierarchy changes, you open the collector, and then you pass up just this one state property. As you notice, the ID set given isn't needed by the upload. The client keeps holds on to it and manages that itself. So on this upload context object, you can import messages, you can import message moves if you move a message from one folder to another, you can import message deletes and read state changes. Now message moves is basically a way to tell the server, I moved this item from this folder to this folder, and it just does an on server move, so you're not actually copying the content up and then deleting it from the source. It's kind of a more efficient way. And then for hierarchy, you can import hierarchy changes, and then you can import deletes. Those are the only two operations you can do on a hierarchy upload context object. Yes?
How often does the previous slide, how often does the Outlook call these operations? Is it for every message read, every message move, does it call this these operations, or is it every 5 minutes, every 10 minutes?
It's a good question. It internally will make changes in its cache. It depends on which version of Outlook. I think older versions used to be more aggressive with passing up changes, or maybe it was less aggressive. There's a scheduler inside the system in the client where it will upload the changes like every 30 seconds, every 15 seconds. So if you're making a lot of changes, it won't constantly be making calls. But it knows that when you've marked an item as being modified, they're relatively fast. But I think there might be a delay there. When Chris comes later in the day, talks all about Outlook, that's a good question for him. Oh, yes.
The Outlook specific behavior in terms of ICS and how it's used by Outlook to implement the cache mode is captured in the MS OxoSync document, which is kind of informational versus OXC FXACS being kind of normative document. So if you have any Outlook specific questions, OxoSync might be able to answer them, whereas FXACS explicitly doesn't cover how Outlook does it, because that's just one client implementation.
The FXICS document really doesn't cover a lot of client-specific behavior. The OX sync doc covers a lot of the client behavior.
Also, Joe, I think there were some questions before in the audience, I mean, outside of the lecture today, around other things that the client can do with this state, in particular the get incremental state operation. I think it was not in your slides, but since the client can use it and sure. It presents a particular complication for a class of solutions like men in the middle solutions, you might want to just, I don't know.
When I get to the end, I'll remember to talk about that. Or I can catch you at lunch or something. Okay, so when you call import message change, you call it on the upload context object, and there's some import flags. You're saying whether or not you're wanting to upload an associated message, and there's this fail on conflict. Basically what it means, if you say fail on conflict, it tells the server that if I'm trying to upload a message that conflicts with the message that's on the server, fail the call. If you don't pass this flag, it means I'm uploading a message to the server that conflicts with the item that's on the server. It means I want the server to just accept it and deal with it. whether it produces a conflict message or however the server implementation wants to deal with it, it should just accept the message. And then it passes up these four fixed property values. It passes up the source key, the modification time, the change key, and the predecessor change list. Now, this is of the modified item on the client. The client wants to pass up. So it'll probably have a different change key and a modified predecessor change list that represents the changed item on the client. And then, of course, the server will evaluate these properties and determine if the server actually wants the change. And the server might already have the change, and it says no. Actually, I think the next slide describes return success. If the server wants the change, it doesn't have the change, and it wants it, it'll return sync conflict. If there's a conflict and you pass the fail on conflict flag, it'll actually say there's a conflict. And then sync ignore. Basically, the server says, I already have that change. You don't need to pass it to me. Now, on output, it actually returns back a message object. And the message object has been completely stripped. So if you're importing a change to an existing item, the server will evaluate and say, yes, I want that change. It'll open that message. Now, the object that it gives back is that message, but all of the properties have been removed, attachments have been removed, recipient information has been removed, everything's been removed. But it hasn't actually been committed to disk yet. It just means that that representation of that object has been completely shelled out. And it requires the server call set properties, create attachments, and it requires the client to actually write up the entire message into that message object and then call save changes. Upload is not very efficient at all. It's extremely inefficient, but usually in ICS, you're sending up one message at a time. You're not doing a bunch of bulk operations. Generally, a client will download more items than it will actually ever upload, unless you're somebody who really likes to send a lot of mail. Import deletes. You basically, there's a flag that say whether you're uploading. This ROP will actually work against both a hierarchy or a content upload context. So you have to say whether you're doing message deletions or folder deletions. And then there's a property value, and there's just a, it's kind of a weird thing. It's a property value array which contains one property, which is a multi-valued binary, which contains one multi-value, which is it's a multi-value property that contains individual properties, which are, weirdly enough, GIDs, which is a long-term version of, it's FIDMID pairs, I believe. And if it's for hierarchy, the FID is filled in and the MID is just zero. So it's a bunch of FIDMID pairs of items to delete. The documentation will describe what the GUID is and the format and all that far better than I can here. So conflict detection. This is kind of ugly, but the way the server detects conflict, it has these four state properties that are passed up with each message change. You get source key, change key, last modification time, and predecessor change list. Now, the only thing that Exchange Server really uses when it evaluates message conflicts for message uploads is predecessor change list, the very last one. The other properties can be used for conflict resolution, which I don't get into here because I knew I wouldn't have time. The other properties, if once you determine there's a conflict, there's certain rules based on, like last writer wins or produce conflict messages or different behaviors that you can set on folders, it'll use these other properties to determine that. So, in a nutshell, you have two different changes with two different predecessor change lists. You have predecessor change list A and predecessor change list B. A, I think, here is I'm not sure if I listed it, but so A is the version that's on the server, and B is the version that's being passed up. It doesn't really matter which order. I think the evaluation is the same. If I go back, the predecessor change list is this binary property which contains this list of namespace goods and glob counts, and it has a byte at the beginning because the glob counts can vary in size because these are essentially change key values, which is a GUID and glob count. Now, change key values are different. If Exchange assigns them, it's a the glob count is a 6-byte value. If Outlook assigns a change key value, it's a 4-byte value. So they're different in size. So that's why here that in the predecessor change list, you'll have a byte, which basically says how big this GUID plus glob count is. But the GUID here is the namespace GUID. So every Outlook OST instance will assign have its own own set of change numbers that it assigns, so it has its own namespace. So when it assigns a change number, it have its namespace GUID and glob count value, and it will insert that and put it into this predecessor change list. Now, if the namespace GUID already exists in the predecessor change list, it just updates it with the highest glob count for that namespace. So the predecessor change list is kind of a list of all the places in which the item had been changed, all the namespaces or all the mailbox and databases that it had been changed. So the valuation is for every namespace GUID within the first predecessor change list, if there's a corresponding namespace GUID in the second predecessor change list and the two glob counts are exactly identical, then the two items are considered to be exactly the same. Basically means if there's the same number of namespaces and they completely correspond one-to-one and the glob counts are the same, it's the same item. Now, if for every namespace GUID within the second predecessor change list, the first one contains an equal or greater glob count, then the first predecessor change list is essentially newer than the second one, meaning the item associated with PCLA is a newer item of the item PCLB, and there's no conflict. Now, for every namespace GUID within PCLA, PCLB does contain an equal or does contain the same namespace GUID with an equal or greater glob count value, then PCLB is considered, well, I think there's a typo there. PCLB is newer than PCLA. That should be an A. That just basically means that say if there is the case where a client could try to replicate a change up to the server where the server version is newer and the server doesn't want the change, there's no conflict, it's just the server version is newer. And then if none of these three rules above apply or don't pass, then the item is considered to be in conflict. Some quick examples. Say you have PCLA, you have a first change key, you have a the namespace GUID, and then you have a particular glob count, and then you have another change key in that predecessor change list that has a different namespace GUID, has a different glob count, and PCLB, you notice that the GUID A and GUID A, the glob counts are the same GUID, same glob counts. In this example, the item is exactly the same. Nothing surprising. Here's an example of where the client item is newer. Say the server item has a particular GUID with the glob count associated with it, another GUID with the glob count, and the client item's coming in. This GUID namespace, the glob count are the same, but this GUID namespace, the glob count is logically higher. That means the client's change is newer than the server's. There's no conflict, just the client has a newer version of that item. And the server will, of course, will want the item and will return a message object to the client to say, here, give me that change. Here's where the server item is newer. You have GUID A and GUID B, and you notice that these has the same and these are the same, except that the client version is an older version of the one the server has. In this case, the server should return sync ignore and say, I already have a newer version of this item. Usually the server will return sync ignore if the version on the server is equal to or newer than the version the client's trying to pass up. But in this case, the client's trying to pass up an older version and the server just says, no, I don't want it. Here's a version where there's a conflict. Say this is a case where you had an item that existed on the server. It was created on the server. It got a glob count based off the server's namespace. It was then downloaded to the client. The client then changed it. You notice the server's namespace GUID glob count didn't change, but the client modified it. It added its own namespace and its own glob count. It tries to pass this. I should explain. Okay, there's another step here. The item was originally downloaded at this particular version. Somebody modified it on the server, and it got a new glob count. But somebody on the client also modified the item and is trying to pass it up to the server. The server is going to logically see, for this namespace, this doesn't conflict, but there's no corresponding namespace for GUID B. Therefore, there's not a matched pair. This might be newer, but this one is definitely older. The server version for this GUID namespace, since it doesn't have that GUID namespace, would be considered this is a newer and this is older. So it would conflict. It wouldn't match any of the three conditions, and it would be considered in conflict. The server, depending on whether you pass the fail on conflict, will return a sync conflict. If you don't pass the fail on conflict, the server will actually just return success and give you an empty message object, and the client will upload the changes, and the server then just has to deal with reconciling the two different versions of the message. And it could use conflict resolution like last writer RINs or whatever it wants to do. And that is ICS in a nutshell. Again, I'd like to reiterate that this is just a subset of what actually is in the documentation. There's a lot of other functionality with partial item downloading. I can quickly talk about what Gleb had mentioned, where when you create the download synchronization object or the upload synchronization object, and say it's a big synchronization and you're downloading a lot of items, there is a mechanism in which the client at any point can go to the synchronization download context and say, I want to retrieve the current ICS state at this moment. And there's a way to create another download synchronization object off of that synchronization object that will return a fast transfer stream of just the ICS state that represents the state at that moment. Now, this worked fine up until Exchange 2010. In Exchange 2010, we don't actually produce what we call these checkpoint states. The Exchange server, if you try to get a checkpoint state in the middle of downloading a stream, you're going to actually just get the original state that was passed up. The only time you'll get a new state is at the very end of the fast transfer stream. This doesn't really impact the client because the client actually does its own client-side checkpointing. As it's downloading changes, it takes the change numbers and mids and then sets them aside and updates its own state. So if the connection is dropped in the middle of downloading a large set of changes, when the client reconnects, the state that it passes up will be a slightly modified state, so the server won't download the same changes.
I have a question with regard to slide 23, maybe, and how can clients can change the states if they want to. So if the client deletes a message, you already indicated that he can change the ICS states because it's a deleted message. The question is, like, can I do the same thing as a client for change evaluation or read states evaluation? I'll just give you an example. Let's say I choose to do fast transfer without the ICS part of it, and then just change the state on the client.
Yeah, there's a lot of tricks you could do. You can create your own ICS state.
So that means like the sequence numbers are predefined logic that the client can also create the sequence numbers when it's a new item or something?
Different namespaces. When the client itself, if it's storing items, if it wants to modify items, it'll have its own change number namespace versus what's on the server. So if you're doing fast transfer, you can, you know, if it gives you the change number from the server and you could persist that, then you could potentially produce an initial ICS state if you wanted
based
to.
Based on that?
Yeah.
But if it's a totally new item, then you can't do that?
A new item is that you would have to actually create the item on the client and you'd have to assign it an ID. In the documentation, I didn't discuss it in the slide, there is a way to go to the server and allocate a range of IDs that the client can use. So when it's generating new IDs, it can use a predefined ID. And the reason why we do that is that Like I explained, the ID set needs to be able to collapse well, and you kind of want folder IDs to all be associated within a certain range within a folder. So there's a way to actually go to the server and get a range of IDs. I think the Outlook client, for each folder in the OST, goes and reserves like 64,000 IDs per folder.
So for the download scenario, just skip the state synchronization, but if you want to optimize the upload, you can do put buffers and save all this messy and just update your state.
The problem with fast transfer upload is a copy operation, so it's going to create new items on upload. So if you have changes to existing items, there's no way to really have it go in and just modify that item. It's just going to create a duplicate item. But if it's a new item, you could certainly do that.
Okay, thank you.
All right, I think I'm being told this is I'm way over my time limit, so.